Good morning, everybody. It's good to be back. Sarah and I had a good vacation. I got the sniffles Friday, so I've got a cold, so I'll just be waving. I won't be hugging or shaking hands. Thank you, Art. We're continuing our study in the visions of God, and in particular in the book of Revelation, and we're in chapter 13. This chapter is really the beginning of a section in the book that goes into great detail, albeit very figurative detail, about the persecution of Christians by Rome, especially during the reign of Domitian and afterwards. We're going to talk about that today to understand a lot of the imagery that's going to be discussed in the first verse, even, of this chapter. We're going to have to do some Roman history. We're going to have to look at the reigns of various emperors. And we're going to talk a little bit about the various theories about when the book of Revelation was written, because they all have to do a lot with understanding where this imagery fits in Roman history, in the history of the first and second centuries. And so we're going to spend some time doing that. But before we do that, I want us to get the context of the whole chapter, what the whole chapter is about. Remember when we studied chapter 12, which we studied for several weeks, we had the woman, the glorious woman, appearing as a sign, ready to bear the man-child, Jesus. The child's born and snatched up to heaven. The dragon is introduced. The dragon's waiting to devour the child when it's born. He misses his chance. So then he tries to persecute the woman, misses that chance. Then he decides he's going to make war on her children, the rest of her offspring, those who obey the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so that is the last verse of chapter 13. I'm sorry, chapter 12. He says, here he's going to take off and start making war. So guess what happens in chapter 13? The war. You start seeing Satan marshaling his troops, marshaling his allies, and putting them to work. Now we've already, as we've learned in the book of Revelation, the way the story is told, it's told several different times in different ways in the same book. Right? And we know this from several different examples. So one example is this time period that keeps showing up. Time, times, and half a time, 1260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years. Keeps showing up all the time, right? The witnesses show up, they do their work for that period of time, and then the beast that rises out of the bottomless pit makes war against them and kills them, okay? Then you have the woman who is protected for that period of time. You have we're going to find out here, the beasts are given their power for this period of time. So, you know, we know that what we're looking at, it's sort of like you're looking at, I don't know if I can really explain this right. I'll try to a little bit. So primitive animation. So today we have computer animation, you know, we have these amazing three-dimensional cartoons that look real, so real you can't even, hard to tell. But really, really primitive animation, when you first started animation, there were two things people did. They had something called a flip book. Some of y'all probably had some as kids. I did. Right? And it had little pictures, and you'd flip it and look at the pages as they came by. And every picture had a different, you know, a different motion on it. And then when it flipped by, you'd see the whole picture. You'd see the movie. There was something else that happened around the time that flip books were created as well, way, way back. Right? It was called a zoetrope. Now, a zoetrope had all the pictures inside of a cylinder, and it had slits in the cylinder. And you would spin the cylinder on an axis, and you'd look through the slot. And what you'd see is you'd see the animation. That was the first movie, was a zoetrope. Now, the reason I'm bringing all this up is that if you looked at any one picture, you didn't see the movie. You had to look at them all at once. Right? And that's kind of what's going on here in Revelation. Any one of these little things says something important for us to know. Like the witnesses. The witnesses You know, they're given a job to do, they do their job, and they're protected for 42 months, and then they die. Right? But then it talks about the woman, and the woman is protected from the dragon for 42 months. You know, and then there's war that they're going to make against the saints for 42 months. And every one of those is like one of those pictures in the movie. And there's so many dimensions, there's so many angles on this, that that's the only way you could really tell the story in a linear book, which is what we have here, right? We don't have a three-dimensional extravaganza going on. We have a linear book with linear language written in a line. And so when we look at this chapter, and really the next couple of chapters, which gets very heavily into the actual persecution of Rome and eventually the judgment and defeat of Rome, the great harlot, it's talked about later in chapter 17. We're going to see yet again a different angle, and some of it's going to be expanded a little differently. Now, this isn't new to us. We saw a similar thing in Daniel. You remember Daniel's visions? We're going to go read chapter 7 of Daniel today because it's important for us to get into the context. Remember Daniel's, the first vision of Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel interpreted, the great idol? Right? The head of gold. I mean, I don't know how many times I've referred to this. It's important because it lays out the framework of history from the time of Daniel until the time of Christ. You know, the head of gold, it's the Babylonian Empire. The arms of silver, which is the Medo-Persian Empire. The belly of thighs of bronze, which is the Greek. The legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay, which is the Romans. And then the stone cut without hands, out of a mountain without hands, and stripes the statue on the feet, and it blows into dust, and it grows into a kingdom that is never given to another. That was basically the interpretation of the first vision that Daniel interpreted. But then later in Daniel, we see different parts of that big whole span elaborated on. We have one thing where it talks about the leopard and the bear. We're going to talk about that in chapter 7, Daniel, today. There's another place where it talks about it talks about the lion with wings. It talks about the bear with the three ribs in its mouth. It talks about the leopard with the wings, four wings and four heads. And then it talks about this great beast, this monster with 10 horns and iron teeth and bronze claws. Right? And so it's taking a different angle on the same set of empires. And then in one place it says, oh, well, now there's this other thing. There's this he-goat. You know, and it's got two horns, and one's kind of smaller than the other. And then you've got this ram, and he's got one horn, and he comes and beats up on the he-goat and stomps it to death. And then the horn's broken off, and four horns grow up out of it. And we said, okay, so that's the Medo-Persian Empire and Alexander the Great conquering them, and then him dying, and the four emperors or the four kings coming out of his generals. And then later in Daniel, it zooms in even more. It starts talking about the whole history of the Seleucid and Ptolemaic dynasties, which were two of those generals, the two dominant ones. They go all the way, they fight back and forth across Palestine for hundreds of years, until finally the Romans come on the scene and get rid of the northern kingdom, the Seleucid kingdom, and eventually take over the Ptolemaic kingdom too. I mean, Mark Antony, Cleopatra, and all that kind of stuff happens. And then Rome is the only one on the stage. Right? But all these other kingdoms are still around. They're just part of Rome. Rome conquered them. And so we're going to see that in this. And in Daniel, Daniel was showing all different angles of what was going on. And then Daniel says, well, what's going to happen to my people? And he has the vision of the 70 weeks, which talks about when the Messiah is going to come. It talks about all the things that happened in between those times. And so in that same style, Revelation, it discloses different angles of what's about to happen to the church. Now, as I've said before, there's lots and lots of controversy about what all this means. It's a very deep book. It's got a bunch of stuff in it that is hard to understand without a reference to history, and hard to understand without a perspective from the first century. And both of those we only have partial understanding of. What's the nature of history? You probably heard this before. Who writes history?
The victor.
Right? The one who won the war gets to write the history of the war because the other people are dead, right? So, you know, Can you always trust everything you read in a history book?
No.
No, because it's all written from a perspective. Right? It's all written from a perspective. You can see this in Josephus. Josephus was a great Jewish historian. He was also a general in the Jewish army who ended up defecting to the Romans and was an eyewitness. He served as a translator and a counselor, an advisor, to Titus, who later became emperor, but before he became emperor, he was the ruler over the army that destroyed Jerusalem. And Josephus writes about it in great detail. He was there. Now, Josephus is a pretty reliable historian. He tells lots of stuff. But you always have to keep in mind that he served the ruler. So he writes the most amazing stuff about Herod the Great. I mean, he makes Herod the Great sound like he's just the best thing on the planet. Guess who he worked for at the time? Herod the Great. Right? So he's not going to say Herod was this despicable person who went and slaughtered all the children in Bethlehem. Right? What's he going to say? He's the greatest guy in the world, right? Because he pays his paycheck and keeps his neck on his head, on his shoulders. And so that's what you have to always keep in mind with history. History is always written from a perspective. The difference between history and Scripture is Scripture is true because it comes from God. It's inspired. You can always trust that it is true. You may not know what it means, because you may not have read some other bit of context you needed to know, or you may have been, your mind may have been conditioned by stuff you've been taught all your life. You know, like if you were raised Catholic, and some of us were raised Catholic, if you were raised a Catholic, you would have been taught your whole life to chapter 12 in Revelation, when it talks about the glorious woman, that was Mary. You'd have been taught that your whole life. And it would be hard for you to prune away that teaching, to take a fresh look at what the book says. The book is not Mary. But if you were taught your whole life it was Mary, it's hard to get rid of that in your head. This is true about people who come from different religious beliefs that have other strong interpretations of Revelation. For instance, Maybell Hudson and her husband Adam Hudson, who serves as one of the elders. Maybell's going to speak at Our Lady's Day. They were once, many, 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 many years ago, Jehovah's Witnesses. They haven't been for 20, 30 years now. And he's, you know, he's been a faithful gospel preacher and elder in the church and other things. You know, he's a faithful Christian. But he came out of a set of teaching about these prophecies that is very, very different than what he teaches today. Right? And he had to go through that transition of understanding it. And all of us who come from a different religious training in our lives have to do that. We all have to do that. We have to say, okay, hold it. Is this really what the Bible's saying? Or is this what I've heard all my life? And you really have to be careful about that. Now, okay, so let's talk about this a little bit. The reason I bring up all this history is there are some really interesting clues in Scripture as to the placement of when this book is written. And we're actually going to find it, in chapter 13, we're going to have this description of this beast that rises up out of the sea with seven heads and ten horns. But chapter 17 talks about the same beast and gives a little more detail. In fact, an angel says, hey, John, let me help you understand what this is. And he starts talking about what the heads are seven hills. The seven heads are seven hills. There are also seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and one is yet to come, and he must continue a short space when he comes. So, okay. That gives you some ideas. But here, this one, we just see these eight. We see these seven horns. When we look back at our seven heads, when we go back to Daniel, we see this one beast. Doesn't say it has multiple heads, so you just assume it has one. And it has ten horns, and it says one of the horns, a little horn, sprouts up later and roots up three horns and speaks great words of blasphemy against God. You know, so all of these things are very symbolic, right? It says horns. What does it mean? It says a beast with seven heads. What does it mean? You're going to see this over and over and over. And so we're going to study a little bit of history today, but I want to get into context of Scripture first. So first of all, I want to read the first part of chapter 13. Now, rolling into chapter 13, just to finish chapter 12, here we go, verse 17, chapter 12, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. 13:1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. An authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Now, verse 11 says, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. We're going to wait on that one. Okay? So, we have this vision. First of all, John all of a sudden is standing on the seashore. Now, there's a little bit of difference in the translations here. If you follow the ASV translation, it says, and he. The antecedent is the dragon. Okay? So either you got the dragon on the seashore calling up the beast, or you have John on the seashore watching this beast come up. But one way or the other, the beast is coming up. So there's this beast that shows up. And I tell you what, Jim McGuigan had a great comment on this chapter. He said, this is like, you can see that this is like a science fiction movie. You know, we were talking about a science fiction movie, right? You've got monsters coming up out of the earth and out of the sea with multiple heads and all this stuff and just crazy stuff going on, right? Really spectacular visionary things. Nobody ever, even the people who want to make this book as literal as possible, believe that there's a literal beast coming out of a literal sea with 7 literal heads. Even the people who want to try to make the book completely literal can't do that. But they'll try to tell you all kinds of things of what it means. But let's let the text talk about it itself, because this is very, very relevant to Daniel chapter 7. Now let's look at this a little bit. He's on the sea. He sees the beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. There's those numbers again, 7 and 10. Who also had 7 heads and 10 horns? We had it in just the last chapter.
The devil?
The dragon, right, the devil. The dragon, great red dragon, right, with what? 7 heads and 10 horns. So here comes this beast, and what does he have? 7 heads and 10 horns. What does it say later? Where does the beast get his power from? It says, the dragon. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So we know who this beast serves. It's Satan. We know whose ally this beast is. We know whose enemy this beast is. It's the enemy of the Christian. Because the prior chapter, the last verse says what? The dragon's going to make war against the saints. So he says, come on, boys, let's go make war. And he calls up his allies. Then he's going to call up two. The first one is the beast from the sea. It makes it very clear, especially in 17, it says it flat out. You know, this is the city that rules over all the nations of the earth. This is the city that sets on 7 hills. This is Rome. There's no, really, it's very, very difficult. If you're going to be consistent with all the clues in the scripture and even very plain statements, it's really hard to get other things out of this, although people will, because one, they have some point they're trying to push. So if somebody wants to put it all, and I've told you this before, some people want to try to make this all apply to the destruction of Jerusalem. And I'll tell you a reason for that here in a minute, because of the dating and the times. But then they have this problem, because it says the city, in chapter 17, talks about the harlot who rides on the scarlet beast with the seven heads and 10 horns, right? And says she is this great city that rules over all the kings of the earth. Well, Jerusalem never did that. So it's a little hard to say that that's Jerusalem. Jerusalem never did that. Never, ever. You know, the extent of the Davidic kingdom and Solomon's kingdom still was limited to Palestine. I mean, it didn't go down. They never ruled Egypt. They never ruled Turkey. They never ruled anything out close. So, you know, there's things like that that just go, okay, can't be that. Can't be that. But let's see what else we learn. Okay, this beast, 7 heads and 10 horns. Again, 10, the number of completeness. You got a full count. You got everything you need, like 10 fingers and 10 toes. 7, you got perfection normally. At least completeness. And 10 crowns. And on his heads, a blasphemous name. Or in other translations, and on his heads, names of blasphemy. Now, one way or the other, whether it's one name or multiple, the heads have blasphemy associated with them. What is blasphemy?
To speak evil against.
Excuse me?
It involves speaking. It's evil, but it involves speaking evil against.
If you say that something that God has done is attributed to the devil, for instance, that is blasphemy. That's kind of the reference you're using.
That's not true.
Well, it is something that's not true, but it's more than that. It's something that is true about God that you're saying is not true. Like if you say God doesn't exist, well, that's blaspheming because God says I do exist, right? If you say the earth was created by Satan, that's blasphemy because God created the earth and you're saying no. You see, that's the thing. The other way that you can look at this, and obviously we know what happened because we know what happened with at least some number of the Roman emperors, especially the one that's going to be highlighted here, probably Domitian, was they started saying, I am God, and you will call me God, and you will worship me as God, and we're going to build temples to the worship of me and my ancestors as gods. Now, you know, that's kind of the ultimate blasphemy. The ultimate blasphemy you could ever do is to say, but you're not God, I am. Right? So first of all, we know whatever these heads are, and if you were reading the book for the first time, you wouldn't know about chapter 17 yet. You'd say, whatever the heads are, they're associated with blasphemy. Now, the beast which I saw, verse 2, was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Bear, leopard, and lion. Where have we heard those before? In Daniel. In fact, we're going to hear them here in Daniel chapter 7. And it's even interesting the order at which they are. What does he say? A leopard, a bear, and a lion. Remember that. The dragon gave him his power and great authority. Now we're going to go to Daniel chapter 7 because I want to cover this bit. So let's get back to Daniel chapter 7. Now this is one that bears reading through, so I'm going to read through the whole thing. Read along with me. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and the visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirred up the great sea, and four beasts came up out of the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till his wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Then suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. And the beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrible, exceeding strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up from among them, before whom 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame, and its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. And I watched till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. And as for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And as I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, both in my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one who stood by, and I asked him the truth of all this. So he told me, and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts, which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceeding dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and stamped the residue with his feet, and the 10 horns which were on his head, and the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth and spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different than the first ones. He shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for time and times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts troubled me greatly, and my countenance changed, and I kept the matter in my heart. Now, that should ring a whole lot of bells. You should have bells and flags going off all through the reading of that. But remember, this is hundreds and hundreds of years before. This is at least 400 years when Daniel's having this vision before John's having this vision. But what do you see that's similar? First of all, you see that lion, the leopard, and the bear show up, and what are they? Says very plainly, they're kingdoms. When you get to that fourth beast in Daniel, it's different than the other ones. And it's terrible. And there's 10 kings that come from it. It says the 10 horns were 10 kings. And then another one came up who rooted up 3 of the kings and spoke pompous words. If you read that in the King James, it says blasphemous words. So you've got this king that's going to arise from this kingdom, which is Rome. It's the one that followed the Greeks. And in fact, conquered all the other areas. That's why in Revelation 13, it says the beast had parts of a leopard, parts of a lion, and parts of a bear. It's made up of those kingdoms. Did you notice in Daniel 7, it said the other beasts were not destroyed, but they basically gave up their kingdom, and they were allowed to live for a period of time. They were allowed to live because they were incorporated into Rome. Rome was one of the first mega nations in that, you know, Rome started in Italy. And they started, because they were seagoing people, largely, and heavy into commerce. But then they started spreading and spreading and spreading and spreading. The reason they took over the known world there at the time in the Mediterranean, in Europe and Africa, in the Middle East, was their strategy for economic growth, basically. You go and you conquer a land and you suck all of the value out of it and feed it back to Rome. We're going to hear a lot about that when it talks about the destruction of the harlot, because it's going to say all the merchants of the earth were made rich by Rome. So the easiest way to get a lot of wealth in those days was not to go open up a startup company, you know, and broadcast something and get yourself a website or whatever. The way you did it was you raised an army and you go and conquered the next door neighbor who had a lot of money. And you took it away from them. And you enslaved the people where they had to pay you tribute. Or they had to send all of their lambs or all of their grain or whatever they happened to have, all their wood, to you. And if they didn't do it, you came back and you beat up on them again. So, you know, that's how it grew. Now, Rome, as a nation, turned into this conquering kind of people that spread so fast that eventually they couldn't maintain all of the lands they'd conquered. They became too big for their britches, basically. And each of the kingdoms, which we're going to find out, the ten horns on the beast in Revelation 13, are 10 kings, it says, who have not been given a kingdom as yet, but agree to support the beast. They're the king, they're, you know, like for instance, Herod was an example. Was Herod a king? Yes, he was. Was he subservient to Rome? Yes, he was. Did he have to bow before Caesar? Yes, he did. Right? But he was a subservient king. It's an example of those kings. These regional kings eventually revolt against Rome and destroy Rome, along with the invasions of the Gauls and Huns and Visigoths and all the other external people. So when you see that vision of the statue in the first part of Daniel where it says that the toes mixed with iron and clay, it's iron, but there's clay. And they don't mix together. They don't stick to each other. They don't cleave together. So it was a fragile empire. Rome was always sending legions around to either conquer new space or to put down rebellions in previously conquered space. That's what they did the whole time. We're going to see a lot of that happen, and one of the reasons of it happening when we get to what happened with Vespasian after the death of Nero. But, so in Daniel's account, we see some interesting things. This little horn, which is one of the ten, it's an 11th horn that comes up after the 10. He said these 10 are 10 kings that are going to rise from this nation. That's what the angel told him, so we know that's true. So we've got to find 10 kings somewhere in Rome to know what's going on. And then it says this next one comes up, and he uproots 3 kings. So, okay, we got a reference there. We've got to go figure out if we can learn about that historically. And all this happens for how long? 42 months. Same time period. What happens at the end of it? God judges that nation, that kingdom, that empire, and destroys it. And the saints inherit the kingdom. In other words, the rock cut out of stone without hand that strikes the statue and it destroys it and grows into one that fills the whole earth and is never given to another. See, all of Daniel's visions are all part of one thing. And again, it's a zoetrope. It's all the little facets. Now, let's go back to Revelation. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about these horns and these heads. So we got 7 heads in Revelation, and in fact we'll find out in chapter 17 there's an 8th head too. We'll talk about it a little later. In Daniel we have 10 horns and then there's an 11th. Okay? Daniel says very plainly, the angel tells him, these are kings. So we should say, what were the kings of Rome? The leaders of the Roman Empire. In Revelation 17, it tells us that the 7 heads are 7 kings. So we know that they're kings too. But one's 7 and one's 10. You know, so in one place, the horns of the beast in Daniel are the kings of Rome, basically, the emperors of Rome. In Revelation, the heads are the emperors of Rome, and the horns are the client kings, or the ones that like Festus and Agrippa and Herod. Okay, a little bit of history. So, who was the first Caesar of Rome? First emperor of Rome?
Caesar Augustus.
Okay, you're right, but a lot of people will say, hold it. I've read Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. He was the first Caesar. Well, he was, but he wasn't the first emperor. There's a difference. Rome was a republic for several hundred years. It was a republic. We're a republic. How does a republic govern itself?
Through representation.
Yeah, representation by people who represent the people. Now, Rome had a republican form of government, not versus democratic, but they had a republican form of government. They had a senate, and the senate, the senators, and that's where the word came from, the senators represented regions of the Roman Empire, and they all got together in the Senate building in Rome. Guess why we have a Senate building in Washington, D.C.? For the very same reason. And they got together, and they decided what was best for the people, and they decided where to make war, and who to make, you know, generals, and who to give what to. Caesar, Julius Caesar, was a great general. He went off and conquered Britain and Gaul, basically modern-day England and France. Comes back, and he decides he wants to be the ruler. He doesn't want to be under the Senate anymore, but he doesn't proclaim it. He doesn't do away with the Senate and proclaim himself emperor. He is Caesar. He basically was a tyrant. But the first one to actually do it was Augustus. Augustus reigned as emperor of Rome from 27 BC to 1480. In other words, right across the birth of Christ and up until his teenage years. And then we know from the scriptures, Tiberius, right? Tiberius was the next one. And Tiberius served from 14 to 37 AD. In other words, across the crucifixion of Christ. After that came Gaius, who's also known as Caligula, 37 to 41. Claudius from 41 to 54. And then Nero. And everybody remembers Nero. Nero was really crazy. I mean, all these guys... To be an emperor of Rome, you had to be ruthless and cruel, or you would not survive.
That's why Satan used them.
And hey, they were perfect tools, right? They were ready to do whatever it took to stay in power. Nero was absolutely crazy, and eventually was declared to be an enemy of the state of Rome, the enemy of Rome, a public enemy. He was public enemy number one. He was public enemy of Rome, named by the Roman Senate, and thus committed suicide in 68 AD. 68 AD. What's coming up in 70 AD? Guess what's going on when Nero commits suicide? When Nero commits suicide, his four biggest generals, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian, were scattered throughout the empire, controlling major parts of the Roman Empire. Okay? Galba was in Portugal, in the western part of Spain. Otho, I believe, was in Germany, Vitellius, I'm trying to remember. These two guys were in Germany and Syria. Vespasian was down in Judea. Vespasian was down there with his son Titus laying siege to Jerusalem. We know this historically because when he gets word that Nero died, he beats it back to Rome to become emperor, leaving Titus to finish the job. Okay? Now, you may notice something here. All these guys lived a fairly long time, right? We got almost, 41 years, 16, 17 years, 5 years, a few years, 12 years, whatever. Then all of a sudden, 68 to 69, 69, 69, 69 to 79. Guess what's going on in this time period? Civil war. When Nero dies, his four most powerful generals each decide that they should be Caesar. That they should be emperor. They each control a major chunk of the Roman legions. And of course, their followers want them to be Caesar because that means they all get promoted, right? So guess what happened? When Nero dies, Galba and his soldiers declare him to be Caesar. Okay? Otto does the same thing. Vitellius does the same thing, and so does Vespasian. So there's all these four guys and their armies who are all getting ready, and they had civil war. They fought against each other. In fact, Vespasian conquered Vitellius, if I remember correctly. And so they're all having these wars, these civil wars everywhere. And in the end, Galba, Otto, and Vitellius all either commit suicide or are murdered. And Vespasian is left. Now, what's really interesting about this, and you don't notice this until you really dig into the history of it, The and I'm just going to cover the historical parts of this today. So, in Revelation 17, which we don't have time to read, when the angel says, these seven heads on this beast, which is Rome, there's seven hills and there's seven kings. He says, five have fallen, one is, and one is yet to come. And then later he says, there's going to be another one who's an eighth. And he's like the seven. So he gives us this clue. But what does he say? Five have fallen, one is, and one is yet to come, of the seven he's talking about. Now he's saying this to John, and whenever John writes the book of Revelation, this is when he's told, right? So wherever, whenever that is. There's a lot of argument about when the book is actually written. Some people want to make it written back here in Nero's time because they want to try to apply everything to the destruction of Jerusalem, but we've already shown that doesn't work. The most common dating of the book of Revelation is right around the end of Domitian's time, 95, 96, in that range. Now, one of the problems with that, and there's a little problem with that, is that you also find out when it talks about, and we're going to cover this all next week, when it talks about the head with a deadly wound that was healed, see, the head with a deadly wound is aiming straight at Nero. Nero committed suicide. He was the first to persecute Christians. Remember, this has all got to be in the context of persecuting the church, because that's the whole purpose of the book. Nero was the first one who took on persecuting Christians with a vengeance. Peter and Paul and others were martyred during his reign. Okay? Vespasian and Titus, while they didn't put a stop to persecution, they didn't really go crazy with it. In fact, Vespasian and Titus weren't too enamored about being called gods and all that kind of stuff. They thought it was kind of silliness. Domitian, however, who was also, Titus was the son of Vespasian, so was Domitian. Domitian, however, renewed persecution of the church with a vengeance, and also demanded that he be called our Lord God and the only one. He also deified his father and his brother and built large temples to Jupiter and to them in Rome and in other places like Ephesus. So the most common dating of Revelation is toward the end of Domitian's reign. But you say, hold on a second. If the deadly wound, you know, well, for one, you got the persecution, you got this gap in persecution. You got Nero who persecuted Christians, and you got this gap of like 20 years where there's not a lot of persecution, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of persecution. And from you looking at it, it sounds like, okay, there's some other historical references. Tertullian and Eusebius and I think Irenaeus all said that Domitian was like a, one of them called him a limb of the bloody Nero. Another one, there were rumors all over Rome during Domitian's reign that Nero had come back from the dead because he was acting like Nero. He was starting to persecute Christians. So you have all this discussion about where all this happens. The interesting thing about chapter 17, which we really have to study in the context here for 13, is it says five have fallen. If you mark off these five, one, two, three, four, five, one is, well, somebody in this is the is, and one is yet to come, and when he comes, he will come a short space of the seven, right? Okay, so first of all, John, when Daniel refers to the ten kings, he includes these. When John refers to them, he doesn't include them. And the reason is, even though people were running around claiming themselves to be Caesar, nobody was Caesar over Rome until the Civil War was over, and when they were done, it was Vespasian. So that's what the difference between the seven and the ten are. What's fascinating about this, it says, one, five are fallen, one is. If that's true, then the one is, when the vision's being given, is Vespasian. Vespasian's emperor of Rome from 69 to 79. Then he dies. Then his son Titus takes over from 78 to 81. Notice that's just a very short time. Remember it says, five have fallen, one is, and one is yet to come, and when he comes, he must continue for a little while. Turns out Titus continued for a little while. There's all these little clues everywhere. Now the interesting thing about Domitian, So if you said, okay, when John got the vision, Vespasian was emperor, if you believe, if you want to take that position, then you have to put, somehow put John on the Isle of Patmos in that time period, because he starts off the book and he says, I'm here on the Isle of Patmos. Now, all the other historical references that we have, written by the victors, which interestingly enough were the, they're called the Apostolic Fathers, or basically some of the early leaders of, later leaders, second century leaders of the church, and also into the early leaders of Catholicism, they say that the book didn't appear until around 95. And they also say that one of them says that John wasn't exiled to Patmos until about 14 years into Domitian's reign. And Domitian didn't start his persecution until about 14 years into his reign. So one way or the other, there's a little bit of conflicting historical evidence here. Like I said, you can't, you know, you can't take historical evidence as scripture. But fascinating thing about this is, remember in Daniel, it said one horn comes up after the ten. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Hold it. Did I count right? 5. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. One horn comes up after the ten and uproots 3. Now how could that be? This is, he's the son of Vespasian. These guys were gone long before Vespasian ever became, well, long before Domitian became king. How could that be? Turns out, I'll stop here. Vespasian had two sons, Titus and Domitian. Titus was the general. He was the leader. He was down in Judea with Vespasian when Nero died. Okay? He was there. Guess where Domitian was? Back in Rome. And of course, his father was a general, so guess what post he had? He was in the military. He was back home at the Capitol building, basically, when all these messengers start coming in. Now remember, they didn't have the internet, they didn't have telephones or telegraphs. It took a while for Galba's people from Spain to ride their chariot as fast as they could all the way to Rome to say, Galba is emperor. Murdered, war and suicide. Guess who was back in Rome orchestrating things to try to make sure that his daddy, Vespasian, became emperor? The 11th king who uproots 3. Fascinating. We'll stop there.